Welcome to the SMA edition of Rare Disease Advisors' Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the spinal muscular atrophy community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're at the World Orphan Drug Congress taking place at Maryland's National Harbor and speaking with Dr. Al Friedman, a Philadelphia area psychologist who specializes in supporting families affected by rare disease. Dr. Friedman lost his son Jack to spinal muscular atrophy. He was diagnosed in 1995 at the age of 6 months with type 1 SMA and passed away in October 2021 at the age of 26. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Larry. I'm honored to be here.
So in your presentation, you talked about the lessons you've learned as from being a rare disease father and a psychologist who counsels families affected by rare disease. How can we summarize these lessons?
Well, first, the lessons I've learned did not come from professors in graduate school. The lessons I've learned mostly came from my son, Jack, who lived for 25 years longer than we expected. I've learned a whole lot from my son, including that anything is possible if you're creative. Community is so important to our families. It's really hard to live with uncertainty. The trauma of a rare disease diagnosis is real for our families, and many other lessons along the way that have informed my experience and informed my work with other families who find themselves facing adversity.
What background do you have, both in psychology and specifically in training for specializing to counsel families in rare disease?
Well, I started out as a classroom teacher in the Quaker schools in Pennsylvania working with kids. And I went back to school when I was about 30 to get a PhD in counseling psychology. When I finished my training, right when I was finishing my internship, my doctoral internship, Jack was diagnosed with SMA and we were told he would only live for a year. So I was in shock and I needed a psychologist while I was becoming a psychologist. The 26 years with my son were my training in addition to my formal training to be helpful to other people in a clinical setting.
Had you heard of SMA prior to this diagnosis?
Not at all. No.
You didn't know what it was? You weren't familiar with it?
Had no idea what it was. The pediatrician at Jack's 6 month appointment, his pediatrician checkup, noticed that our baby wasn't sitting up and wasn't rolling over. We didn't know there was any problem. And then 4 days from that 6 month checkup, a pediatric neurologist told us that Jack was affected by spinal muscular atrophy and that there was no treatment and cure. We were entirely in shock, had no idea what SMA was, and they told us there was really nothing we could do for him and we'd have him for about a year. It was a very traumatic and disorienting experience as a parent.
Now, as you mentioned, at that time there were no therapies for spinal muscular atrophy. Today there are 3 FDA-approved treatments, and all have been approved in the last 6 years. This is a sea change from what you experienced and for what families are going through today. And yet there still is no real cure for the disease, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. The 3 approved treatments have entirely transformed our SMA community. Babies who are born now are screened at birth. 99% of babies in the United States are screened for SMA at birth and can receive treatment very quickly. If my son was born now, he would have been screened at birth in Pennsylvania and offered one or more of those 3 approved treatments, and he could be walking. The children are being saved, and our community is being transformed by the advances in science. It's a remarkable thing to have observed from 1995 to now. I like to say that I'm from the Flintstones era of SMA, and we're now dealing with the Jetsons. It's a great sea change. But there's not a cure, and my son is one of many in our community whose lives have been lost since the treatments have become available. There's still a lot of work to do.
And yet it took a long time to get so many states on board with newborn screening. As I understand, only Hawaii and Nevada don't screen for SMA.
It's a state-by-state process, and the states, thankfully, over the years have signed on and are recognizing the value and the life-saving value at this point of screening babies at birth.
So I want to talk to you about some of the points you made as a psychologist who counsels families dealing with rare disease of all types. You have to be, as a psychologist and also as a father, you also have to be familiar with those diseases. We're talking about anything from Huntington's, it could be Duchenne muscular dystrophy, it could be any number of genetic diseases, some of which we didn't even know about 10 years ago. How do you get that base of knowledge to know about so many diseases in order to treat these families?
It's impossible for any healthcare professional to have a deep knowledge base of all of the rare diseases that are out there. I do my best as a healthcare professional to learn as much as I can. When I meet a family or I interact with an organization, I interact with many rare disease advocacy organizations as a consultant and doing support groups. I do my best to learn everything I can from what I can read, but more importantly, if I have the opportunity to meet an actual patient or a bunch of patients in person, now that COVID's over, that makes me feel more credible as a professional when I'm helping. I'll also say that although there's a wide range of experiences and symptoms and challenges medically and physically, the psychological impact of rare disease, I'm learning in my work, has many more commonalities than differences. Our families are, regardless of the disease, disoriented and often traumatized by the experience of receiving a diagnosis, and all of our rare disease families live with some element of uncertainty, and these types of experiences psychologically cross rare diseases is what I'm learning in my work.
In your opening talk, you mentioned survivor's guilt, and that's the guilt that that families may feel about having a child who didn't die from the disease and in fact is living, but yet there's no cure. Can you go into that a bit? What is that all
about? The miracle of science has made it possible for babies with SMA to be symptom-free if they're treated before their muscles weaken. So parents, young parents with babies, are finding out their child has this disease but are then treated. So they experience what I would call a bit of emotional whiplash. They're told their child has a disease that could have once caused them to die, but now this life-saving treatment comes very quickly. Like me, I didn't know anything about SMA. These parents don't either. All of a sudden, they're getting diagnosed with SMA after getting ready to have a baby like everybody else, and they don't see that coming. And then they get treated, and then they're telling themselves, wow, my baby is going to be okay, it looks like, but what about the other families who've lost their kids to this disease? They feel guilty. Some, in my work as a psychologist, tell me they feel awkward and guilty when they interact within our community around families who couldn't benefit from that treatment. In my work with these types of families, I reassure them that many of us, myself included, are actually proud to see the babies doing so well after we worked so hard for so many years to fund research. But these families do feel it's a complicated emotional situation for them to experience that their baby was now saved by this drug and others haven't been. And they're also anxious because there's no cohort group. These are new treatments. So they sometimes will ask me, Dr. Al, how do we know the treatment will last? We don't know 20-year-olds who've had this treatment. So they're still anxious. They still have psychological needs, but they're less visible than the others who have kids with severe limitations physically and adults with severe limitations physically.
What about the financial aspect? We're talking about extremely expensive drugs. Zolgensma is $2.1 million. It's a one-time therapy. As you know, Spinraza is $375,000 per year. Even though insurance may cover that, these are very, very expensive treatments, some of the most expensive in world history. If Sarepta gets its approval, that will likely also be several million dollars as well for Duchenne. How do families deal with this?
Well, I'm not an expert on financial matters, but I will tell you this. My son's care cost about an average of $1 million a year for 26 years. So if it costs $2 million to treat a baby and not have this kind of severe disability, it not only obviously impacts the quality of life for that child and family, it's a money saver. And the second part of the answer to your question is that thankfully, insurance companies and Medicaid have done that same math, I believe, because they are paying for these drugs. Sometimes it takes a little longer than it should to get the approvals, but I think over time that has sorted itself out. So thankfully, the families in the United States, I should say, are not bearing the burden of that cost. Families in other countries where the drug has not been approved or the payers are not paying for it find themselves in a very different situation. And I've interacted with many globally and rare disease groups globally, and that is a problem that needs to be solved.
What about clinical trials? Getting into trials is a challenge for a lot of people, especially with regard to diseases such as Duchenne and SMA. Of course, there are exclusions, there's criteria. You have to be between this age and that age. You have to have the correct mutation. You can't have this exon, et cetera, et cetera. How do families cope with all of that?
Everybody's different. So some families have a really hard time if they're not able to be included. Other families understand why the criteria matter and why the criteria will lead to helping other children. Many of us believe, a lot of the work I've done comes from my belief and my desire to honor my son by helping others. And I had been involved in research early on with Jack that helped me to feel that Jack was helping in his own way and that our family was helping in our own way. And when we see these babies now at our conference who are walking, it gives me a great deal of satisfaction knowing that our experience has led to a very different experience for other families who have been able to benefit from the clinical trials and from the approvals of these drugs.
Let me ask you, how aware was Jack himself about the disease?
On one hand, Jack was the happiest little guy in the world and the happiest young adult in the world because he always had a view of the world from his wheelchair. He didn't lose something he once had. So he wasn't sad about not playing ball with Dad. Dad was. He was happy going to the ball game to watch. He was well aware that he was different. He needed a wheelchair. He had a feeding tube. He had a nurse with him all the time, a special van, and we couldn't do things the same way everybody else did. So he was well aware of his limitations, and as he got older, he was well aware that other kids had passed away of the same condition. He went to a special camp for children who were ventilator dependent and lost 3 or 4 of his friends. He outlived many of his cohorts. So he was well aware of the fragility of his life, yet he was thankful and joyful. It was like a party every day for Jack. He took nothing for granted. He wasn't scared of anything. We had 300 nights in the hospital over 20 years, in and out of the hospital. I really admired my son's resilience and his positive attitude.
Amazing. And in closing, since we are all about out of time, you mentioned some of the gifts that come with being a rare disease parent. Can you elaborate on that?
When I started out early on and I was traumatized by this diagnosis and the reality that I would outlive my son, there was nothing positive about it at all. But when my son didn't cooperate with his prognosis, he lived to his second birthday and his third and his fourth, all the way to 26. Over those years, I came to realize that along with the rare disease came some very unusual gifts, very unusual influence he had on everybody around him. Every time he drove his wheelchair into a room, everybody's big problems got much smaller. He offered the gift of perspective. He was a magnet for open-hearted, compassionate people. Only people who are really good, wonderful people want to get involved in this kind of complicated situation. So I have crossed paths with so many wonderful people, doctors and nurses and wheelchair repair people and occupational therapists and speech therapists, so many wonderful people who choose to help us. And he brought out the best in everybody whose path he crossed. So I see my son as an example. I know many children and adults with SMA and many other rare diseases. They have a lot to contribute, and they require a lot of care in order to contribute what they can to the world. But there are some unusual rare gifts that come along with the rare disease, and it took me, Larry, 20 years to figure that one out.
Dr. Friedman, we're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us today. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.